Hello, welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Hassan here with you for the next half hour. Today's show will be all about health, the physical, emotional, and spiritual health. We'll first turn to Nova Scotia, where the Strongest Families Institute just received a $230,000 boost for its phone-in counseling service.
Anxiety and depression are really impairing people, especially our emerging adults and those communities who may be underserved.
We then make a stop in the province of Quebec, where the Dunham House for Mental Health and Addiction provides care for the province's English-speaking community.
You know, we'll touch upon things like addiction and relapse prevention, but we also talk about communication skills. We talk about regulating emotions, how to work through emotional turmoil, how to work through trauma, you know, stress, anxiety management. And what we really want them to work on is really their self-esteem, their self-confidence.
In British Columbia, a historic child welfare agreement was signed between the province, Ottawa, and its Splatchy Nation.
It's like opening that door and there's some light now. We're going to kick it open for other communities to follow behind us because we're the first one in British Columbia. And I think it's going to be seen for years to come as a turning point for a lot of children in care.
And a cloud of mystery surrounds a disease that plagues more than 100 New Brunswickers. Their symptoms mimic those of the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Health authorities are baffled, families asking for a new inquiry. Happy to have you with us.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
The telephone consultation program run by Nova Scotia's Strongest Families Institute just received a $230,000 boost from the J&W Murphy Foundation. The grant will provide enough money to support hundreds of people over the next 2 years. It will also contribute to run an 8-week program that provides weekly telephone consultations for people dealing with depression and anxiety. President and CEO of the Strongest Families Institute, Dr. Patricia Lingley Potty, says the pandemic left a lot of people in need of a place to talk about what they're going through, especially those aged 18 to 25.
Anxiety and depression are really impairing people, especially our emerging adults and those communities who may be underserved. They're not gaining timely access to really evidence-based services, effective services that can help equip them with these types of skills to really conquer these problems.
The ICAN program offers strategies to help deal with depression and anxiety. Potty offered an example of a simple tip to help manage those issues.
Mental health and well-being is such an important part of our general health, and it's so important to take time for yourself. So I'm always about Dr. Trish tips. Make sure you schedule self-care for yourself every single day, even if it's only 10 minutes. Take 10. For yourself.
Anyone interested in participating in the ICAN program can self-refer by telephone or through the Strongest Families Institute website. Links are available on our webpage. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
And to Quebec now, where mental wellness is also the top priority for the Dunham House for Mental Health and Addiction. To make its program known to the public and health professionals as well, it will be holding an open house later this month to introduce the facility to mental health and addiction professionals. Dunham House is a residential treatment center for individuals 18 years and older, suffering from mental health disorders and concurrent disorders. Dunham House serves the English-speaking community in Quebec's eastern townships. Dunham House hopes to be recognized as the facility that mental health and addiction professionals from across Quebec can turn to if their clients need extra support. Here's Taylor McClure speaking with Anthony Berger, clinical supervisor at Dunham House in Knowlton, Quebec.
So Dunham House, we are a residential treatment facility for those that struggle from substance abuse as well as mental health issues. We cater to the English-speaking community, so we're an English-speaking facility. We do take people who speak French, but the majority of our program programming is all done in English. So it's for, you know, people who are in the area looking for some services for mental health as well as addiction. Our program is 6 months in length, so it's a longer term treatment, which is something that differentiates us from other places and other resources in the province.
Yeah, this is a very rare, I don't think I've ever heard of another place like this in the townships, maybe for the French speaking community, but not for the English speaking community.
Yeah, for sure. We really try and engage in with the population for sure. It's something that for 6 months for mental health is sometimes not enough, but it allows them to have some stabilization. It allows them to kind of get their feet under them, try and develop a quality of life as they get started on the next chapter. And for those that are struggling with substance use addiction, really it gives them a good foundation to kind of just put those coping strategies in place, deal with the underlying issues that are there, and really give them a better quality of life.
And is it like a live-in treatment?
Yeah, facility? So we are inpatient. Okay. So we are an inpatient facility. So residents stay with us for the duration of their program. There are, you know, things like weekends out, depending on where they are in the program. We also encourage visitors and family members to be involved in the care of their loved ones at different points in the treatment. So we do encourage the family to be involved. Yeah.
And what kind of services or programs are set in place at Dunham House? You know, you're speaking about providing coping mechanisms and coping skills. How do you provide these to your clientele exactly?
So our program is designed in three different facets. So what we do is we do psychoeducational based workshops. So a lot of what exists there in terms of programming for people who struggle with mental health or addiction is really based on 12-step approaches, right? And we know from research that that doesn't touch everyone, and especially the population that struggles with mental health or co-occurring disorders. That's not going to be effective for them. So really what we do is we do psychoeducational based workshops on different themes. So, you know, we'll touch upon things like addiction and relapse prevention, but we also talk about communication skills. We talk about regulating emotions, how to work through emotional turmoil, how to work through trauma, you know, stress, anxiety management. We also have individual and group counseling that we offer. And as many of our residents like the therapeutic activities. So we have someone who comes in, does an hour or two with them for pottery. We have a yoga instructor, some physical exercise as well. We have a music therapist that provides music therapy for our residents, both as a group and also one-on-one. And we also have our equine-assisted therapy program, which is done right here in the Knowlton area. And how that works is, you know, a group of residents go for 6 weeks at a time. And it's about horse handling. It's about horse leading. It's not so much about horse riding. And what we really want them to work on is really their self-esteem, their self-confidence, but also their leadership qualities and gaining that confidence with themselves.
Okay. And what... may I ask, like, what age range that you serve in terms of your clientele? Do you serve a specific group of individuals?
Yeah, so we are a facility that works with people 18 plus, so adults.
Okay.
And I mean, really, it really depends. The average age of our residents are typically what we're seeing is, you know, mid 30s, early 40s. That's the average. But we do have people who are much older, in their 50s and early 60s. And we're seeing more and more younger people come into the equation as well, anywhere between the 18 and 24 demographic. So it's an 18 plus facility, but we see a wide range of clients. Yeah.
And from my understanding, Dunham House is a nonprofit organization, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so let's just say someone's interested in perhaps, you know, seeking out your services. Mm-hmm. How does that work in terms of financial wise? Do you have like financial programs set in place, like financial aid programs set in place for them? Or how does that work exactly?
So the majority of our clientele are coming through social assistance. So the government will pay for their stay at our facility. But for those that don't qualify for social assistance, we do have a private paying stream. And and that's how they can access our services.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Now, one of the main reasons why we're here today, Anthony, is to speak about an event that Dunham House has up and coming in a couple of weeks. And from my understanding, it's an open house. So I'll let you dive into that a little bit.
Yes.
More for us.
So we're really excited about having the open house on Saturday, April 22nd. It's catered towards mental health and addiction professionals that might not know about Dunham House or have clients that are struggling with these issues and are looking for more residential care. It's going to allow people to get a sense of what we do. So learn a little bit about our services, meet our staff, and also tour our facility. So to get an understanding of where they're sending their clients, and also to put a name and a face to some of these referrals, and also to understand who they're dealing with at Dunham House. As much as we've been around for almost 20 years, you know, population changes. And so some people forget about us. Some people are not sure where to send their loved ones. So it's about being out there in the community and letting people know that we exist to help them gain a better sense of where they can refer their clients to.
And I'm sure it also kind of helps, you know, professionals that might be looking to, you know, change avenues or looking for a place to work. You might be able to introduce them as well. I'm sure you're always looking for.
Absolutely. It's, you know, trying to work with in the townships and where we are. Again, we service most of Quebec. So, you know, our clients are coming from Montreal. Some of them come from the townships. Some of them come from as far as up north in, you know, indigenous communities. So, you know, we're always looking for different type of staff, more clinicians, more mental health professionals. So that's definitely something that they would get an understanding of what the expectation is and what we do at Dunham House.
Yeah. And why did you think it was important to do something like this? It's not often that people have the chance to actually go in if they're not actually in the within the program or actually work there at the facility.
One of the things is with the pandemic, we definitely noticed, you know, increases in substance use across the board. People's mental health is struggling. And I think it was important that we reconnect with people and let people know that there are options. You know, obviously, a lot of people will either go down the route of mental health, like for individual counseling, or if their mental health is really severe, they'll be in hospitals. But there are different options in between, whether it's outpatient services or inpatient services. And we cater to a wider population. And again, the English-speaking community is not well served. So we really want to make sure that they're covered and they understand that there are resources that exist. And Dunham House is a pretty good resource for them to look into.
That was Anthony Berger, clinical supervisor at the Dunham House, speaking with journalist Taylor McClure in Knowlton, Quebec.
You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
And it's time for emotional and spiritual healing for the Splatchine, a band based in Enderby, British Columbia, as it's the first in BC to sign a coordination agreement with the province and Ottawa to implement Bill C-92. Bill C-92 is also called the Act Respecting First Nations, Inuit, Métis Children, Youth, and Families. The agreement applies to Splatchine and all communities within the Segwépink. It's a $136 million 10-year agreement that will help Splatchine families stay together and keep Splatchine children in their communities instead of going into the provincial foster care systems. It's the fifth agreement to be signed nationally since the Act came into effect in 2020. The signing ceremony was held on March 24th at the Splatchine Center in Enderby in the presence of Federal Indigenous Services Minister Patty Adju and Provincial Minister of Children and Families Mitzi Dean. During the ceremony, many spoke about the significance of this agreement, the work that led up to it, but many also took time to state the grief many have felt over the years. Last fall, the BC government announced it was updating provincial legislation that governs child welfare to give First Nations communities more jurisdiction over children and families. Provincial and federal changes to the Child Welfare Act are to align with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Megan Dooling in Revelstoke, BC, prepared this for us.
And thus, the Splatchine First Nation in Enderby is the first in BC to sign a coordination agreement for children and families with Canada and British Columbia. It's a $136.3 million 10-year agreement. It's supposed to allow Splatchine and all communities within Shepwepmik to continue exercising jurisdiction over their children and families.
It's like opening that door and there's some light now. Now, as we open that door, we're going to kick it open for other communities to follow behind us because we're the first one in British Columbia. So, yeah, very historic in nature. And I think it's going to be seen for years to come as a turning point for a lot of children in care.
Wayne Christian became chief of what was then called the Spalamachine Indian Band in 1980 when he was 25.
The history of our community has been devastated by the 60s scoop. We had over 100 children removed, so I was one of those children. My brothers and my sisters, all 10 of us, were removed. So that had a real big impact on me. And so when we asked our elders, how do we look after ourselves before they implemented sort of imposed white law on us, is they told us we had our own laws, we had our own courts, we had our own jails, we had our own processes. So that's what we stood up in 1980.
In 1980, Christian helped write Bylaw Number 3, a bylaw for the care of our children. The nation has been exercising jurisdiction of their children through this bylaw for 40 years. Doug Thomas is the chief today.
It's rather heartwarming to see that, you know, we're the first in BC to sign this agreement, and that we get the chance to continue what we're doing. So, Cook's Gin.
Patty Haidu is the Federal Minister of Indigenous Services.
This 10-year agreement allows the community now to have the confidence financially that they can plan for the long term.
Haidu says the strength of this agreement between the nation, the province, and Canada is that they can coordinate the care of children from the community who may be in the foster care system. She says it allows the state to reunify children with their families in a more cohesive, less combative way. Mitzi Dean is the Provincial Minister of Children and Family Development.
So our social workers know if they get a call of concern about a child or youth, they ask, the first thing they do is ask, is that child Indigenous? And then they ask, what community or communities does that person belong to? And with a coordination agreement, that gives us much improved mechanisms for then the province, the frontline worker for the province to reach out to the nation and to start talking about and coordinating who's going to respond, when are they going to respond, you know, and who takes leadership on this and what do you need from the province, for example. So it really supports that work in making sure services get to children and youth as quickly as possible.
Chief Thomas and the ministers signed the agreement in front of the community at the Spotsheen Centre in Enderby. The celebration was subdued. Councillors spoke of three members of the nation who recently died and that the community is having a hard time. The ramifications of the 6D scoop and residential school are still here, even as new agreements are signed. Ileana Christian is Wayne's 20-year-old granddaughter.
I'm here with the light and a heavy heart at the same time. These things are always pretty heavy, but I'm glad we are all here on a positive note because we really lack that in our community right now. Yeah.
And this brings you hope that things will, I mean, it's not going to happen overnight, but slowly just, your grandfather said this is like the door opening and the light showing through. Is that, do you feel that?
Yeah, I do somewhat, but then again, it's, you can't always be naive to it because, you know, we're still fighting for the same thing for the past, I don't know, however many decades, but I like to be positive about it, hopeful about it, and this is one big step to bringing everyone back home into where they belong.
Do you think that this is going to work? Do you think that this is going to help kids stay in their homes and stay in the community?
I think so. I'm in the youth department here at Splatson, and I have noticed that many kids have been returning back to their original parents. So, firsthand, yes, I do see it happening, but that's just my take on it. Yeah, it's like, it's hard to get it all to happen collectively, basically. And it's bit by bit. Mm-hmm. All we desire is just getting our children back home. And that's it.
In Revelstoke, I'm Megan Dooling.
Please go to canada-info.ca for the full audio and written versions of this report produced by Megan Dooling. A mystery disease is plaguing citizens of New Brunswick. More than 100 New Brunswick patients are struggling to cope with symptoms of an unknown neurodegenerative illness, and they are calling for a new investigation into potential environmental causes of the condition. Their demands come 13 months after the province announced that the neurological syndrome of unknown cause doesn't exist. But many seem to think that environmental factors could potentially be causing this atypical neurological decline and symptoms that mimic those of the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. New Brunswick's opposition Green Party recently held a news conference alongside people affected by the condition. There are now 147 people demonstrating a rapid onset of severe neurological symptoms, according to the group. Medical testing has shown that many of the patients were exposed to multiple environmental toxins, said Stacy Quigley Cormier, whose stepdaughter is among the patients. In particular, she pointed to the herbicide glyphosate, which is widely used in forestry and agriculture. The group also called for Federal Health Minister Jean-Yves Duclos to unmuzzle federal scientists and launch an investigation with federal experts. The so-called mystery disease has also made headlines internationally with articles and publications, including The Washington Post and The Guardian. More with David Gordon Kosh in Sackville, New Brunswick.
The so-called neurological syndrome of unknown cause is an issue that has dogged the provincial government of Blaine Higgs since March 2021. That's when the issue first came to public attention with the leak of a memo from public health to healthcare professionals. That memo advised health professionals about a cluster of more than 40 people with symptoms similar to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a rare and deadly neurodegenerative disorder. The patients were concentrated in two areas around Moncton and the northeastern part of the province near the Acadian Peninsula. A study published by Public Health in October 2021 concluded that there are no specific behaviors, foods, or environmental exposures that can be identified as potential risk factors.
My name is Stacy Quigley Cormier. We are here today as a group because we are tired of being lied to. Prior to releasing their final report, New Brunswick's Health Minister Dorothy Shepherd and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Jennifer Russell hosted us in a Zoom meeting. We were lied to by health officials in this meeting. We were told that there were no environmental concerns, no shared symptoms among patients, and that they were unaware of multiple families where more than one family member was ill. And the government said they had no ability to test for BMMA, a toxin of concern for scientists that is found in blue-green algae. None of this was or is true. We want to confirm that in recent months, patients have tested positive for multiple environmental toxins, including glyphosate, with detectable levels between 4 and 40 times the average limit. Yet, New Brunswick continues to be completely cut off from access to scientific experts due to the federal government retracting funding and services. We view the actions of both federal and provincial officials as an abuse of power.
That was Stacy Quigley Cormier, and before that, Steve Ellis, speaking on behalf of family members struggling with a debilitating neurodegenerative condition in New Brunswick. MLA Megan Mitten, the Green Party's health critic, who spoke at the news conference, also raised the issue during question period in the legislature. Here's part of her exchange with Minister of Health Bruce Fitch.
The provincial government is blocking key research from being carried out. In a letter written to Public Health Canada and Public Health New Brunswick on January 30th, Dr. Ali Marrero once again raised his concerns about the unexpectedly high number of early onset or young onset progressive neurological syndromes in New Brunswick. Over the past year, he has been following 147 cases of patients suffering from neurological symptoms, which includes 57 early onset cases and 41 young onset cases. Will the Minister of Health get out of the way and allow the Public Health Agency of Canada to launch an investigation?
Minister of Health.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I appreciate the question here today, and I appreciate the individuals and their families that are involved in this situation. And Mr. Speaker, I can understand their frustration. Obviously, they're here today to express that, and I appreciate that. It's been one of the files that I've seen when I inherited the Department of Health, and they dove into quite extensively. That letter has been received, Mr. Speaker, by myself or by the department. Public Health is reviewing the contents of that letter, and they are drafting a response. The inference that the member opposite makes about me standing in the way is incorrect. Mr. Speaker, there's a high degree of cooperation between New Brunswick Public Health and the Public Health Agency of Canada. And Mr. Speaker, the Public Health Agency of Canada supported the results of the provincial investigation. That's the fact of the matter, Mr. Speaker. And the feds, they can investigate if there's reason to believe there's a cluster of common cases that spans more than one province. And Mr. Speaker, they looked at the results of the investigation that was done here in the province of New Brunswick by the experts, and they concluded the similar outcome. So that is why the further investigation stopped, is because Public Health Agency of Canada agreed with the findings that were found here in the province of New Brunswick. So I suggest the member opposite appreciate what she's trying to do here. But Mr. Speaker, those are the facts.
That was Minister of Health Bruce Fitch responding to MLA Megan Mitten in the Legislative Assembly on Tuesday. The Public Health Agency of Canada provided an emailed statement. It said in part that the agency provided support as requested by New Brunswick throughout the investigation until its conclusion. And it said the agency acknowledged the investigation's finding that this cluster does not represent a neurological syndrome of unknown cause. A spokesperson for the Provincial Department of Health provided an emailed statement saying the government's investigation into the matter has been extensive. The effort involved a team of independent neurologists and a team of epidemiologists and consultations with a number of other experts, according to the statement. Well, Matthew Betty is a specialist in infectious disease modeling at Mount Allison University, who is currently studying this neurological syndrome. On Tuesday, he updated CHMA about his research after checking out the news conference. He pointed to disturbing data about New Brunswick from the Canadian Creutzfeldt-Jakob Disease Surveillance System, or CJDSS, which is operated by the Public Health Agency of Canada.
There's stuff out there. There's writing on the wall where, you know, if you look at the number of cases that the CJDSS is given every year from each province, for some reason, they're always given more from New Brunswick, and that number is rising faster than it is in other provinces. They publish a report every year with how many cases per province are brought to their attention. And they, for privacy reasons, says nothing about the outcome of those tests. It doesn't say anything about how many are confirmed or how many are not, but there are more brought forth from New Brunswick than other places in the country. You know, even when you control for age, there's still more that go. There's still more candidate cases from New Brunswick, and that number increases. It has been increasing faster than other provinces. And, you know, this is data that's out there. It's just, it's in these reports that are buried deep in archives.
So as mentioned, we had people at that news conference today representing patients or families of patients. And one of them said that many of the people, of these people have tested positive for environmental toxins, particularly linked to the herbicide glyphosate. And there was also mention of blue-green algae, which has been spreading in waterways in New Brunswick, linked to global warming. What do you make of this?
I mean, it's honestly the one of the top hypotheses that we're trying to work with, is this glyphosate or blue-green algae in the environment causing this, because both of them can cause, in high doses, extreme neurological events or problems. And so it's not surprising that maybe people are testing positive for high doses of this, to see if it's actually, you know, if there's maybe a causal link there. There should be, and this is where a wider research project should happen.
That was Professor Matthew Betty of Mount Allison University.
The complete documentary is available on canada-info.ca. And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, David Gordon Kosh, Ed Halverson, Megan Dooling, and Taylor McClure, National Editor Maureen McEwen. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao. We'll be right back.
Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.